We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at Uni Church on the campus of UNSW, which was attended primarily by undergraduate and postgraduate students who lived on campus or in the suburbs surrounding the university.
If you look on the outline on the right-hand side, you will see a timeline presented, and I want us to run quickly through that, the aim of which is to get an overall view of the history of Israel. You need it, really, to understand the Bible. It's one of the great problems of the Bible. There's so many details, it's hard to get the overall perspective of what it's about. And that's part of the aim here now. But I'm only giving, as soon as you do that, the kind of basic milestones of a couple of thousand years of history. You know, it's like giving Australian history as being Captain Cook, Governor Phillip, the Australian Federation, World War I, World War II, and here we are. Now, that's only kind of the most basic framework, isn't it? But yet, you do need that kind of mental framework to have any sense of what Australian history since the whites have been here is about. That's all it is, but it's that kind of framework. And the couple of dates I'll give you, just a couple of dates. I know people get freaked out about dates in history books. There's only a couple of them, and they are crucial ones, and a couple I've picked because they're so, not only crucial, but simple to remember. Now, the numbers will fill in on the way through, but if you'll notice that as a timeline, it doesn't kind of run straight, does it? There's a few bumps on it, and a couple of bits get chopped off. And that's the key points to notice. So I'm going to start on the first run through. We'll run through it twice. The first run through, looking at the bumps on the timeline. The first bump you see is between points 3 and 4. It bumps out to the left. What's that about? Well, that's about the time that the people of Israel spent in Egypt as slaves. Some 400 years, they were down in Egypt as slaves. Don't worry how they got there, don't worry how they got out. You'll know that story, we just sang about it, but don't worry about that. That's what that bump is about. It's about the time they were in slavery in Egypt. The next kind of distortion to the timeline occurs at points 7 and 8, when the people of Israel split into two kingdoms. The one on the left is Israel. That is the northern kingdom of Israel. Funny business, really, you see. One half of the nation Israel retained the name Israel. And so from here on in, it gets ambiguous, doesn't it, as to whether you're referring to the whole nation or just to that splinter group. 10 out of the 12 tribes actually go north to Israel. And if you just follow their history down, you'll see they get chopped off at point 9. That is 722 BC. That's just a significant date. They got split together. The point 7 occurs at 922 BC. So if you want to get something of an idea of the length of time, it's not drawn to scale, by the way, beautiful as it is. It's not drawn to scale. But point 7's at 922 BC. Point 9, the destruction of the Israel, happens at 722 BC. Easy to remember, isn't it, you see? None of our figures will be hard to remember tonight. The Assyrians come in at that point, and they destroy the northern nation Israel. 10 out of the 12 tribes are not reconstituted again. That's the end of them. On the right hand side is Judah, point 8. That's the nation Judah now. It's two tribes of the nation of Israel, Judah and Benjamin. They form a confederacy against all the others, or all the others form a confederacy against them, depending which side of the coin you want to be on, in the great civil war. And they continue down past the Assyrian invasion until they get taken off in the next bump, and that's the Babylonian exile. When the Babylonians came, destroyed Jerusalem, captured the people of Judah, and took them off into slavery. That happens in the 6th century. They're not dates particularly to remember, except they're important. These are the hardest ones, I guess, to remember. That they actually get taken off in about 590 BC. I say about because they got taken in about three waves, different times over a period of some 12, 15 years. But 590 is the round figure. And they come back in 538 BC. Well, that's the edict when they're allowed to go home. So it's a very short time that they spend there. You can see it's not to scale because that's 70 years, whereas the Egyptian ones are about 400 years. And then the nation continues down onto the time of Jesus. So the bumps that you've got, the interruptions you've got, are firstly the slavery in Egypt, then the division of the kingdom, the destruction of the northern kingdom of Israel in 722, the Babylonian exile of the southern kingdom in 590 through to 538. That's simple enough so far, isn't it? So you see, you can divide the periods or eras of the history of Israel as the time before Egypt, the united kingdom from the time of Egypt down through to the time of the division, the divided kingdom with its destruction of the northern half or the northern 5/6, and then the exile as the next major event that happens. You'll see then that the Exodus and the exile are miles apart, aren't they? One happens back about the 13th century, and the other happens around about the 6th century. So about 800 years apart. A long, long distance apart in time. Quite different things, the Exodus and the exile. The first question was the easy one, true and false, just to help encourage you. I can't tell you how old I was before I found out the difference. Now, let's run through the thing from the beginning. Now we'll run through and pick out the significant things that are happening on the way through. Firstly, back in the first 11 chapters of Genesis, Genesis 1 to 11, we have what is called the prehistory period. It's not really prehistory. You can't be prehistory, really. It's just the historians don't know much about it. It's the historians, not prehistory, but we'll call it prehistory. It's the times when it's very hard to date anything or be specific. The stories of Adam and Eve, the stories of Cain, Abel, the flood, the Tower of Babel, all those occur in that first 11 chapters. And it's not just the history of Israel there, it's the history of mankind. Number two is the beginning of this main theme of the Bible with the man Abraham. He occurs, and Abraham I've got against number two, he occurs around the 18th century BC. He is the man chosen by God for God's purposes and from whom the whole nation of Israel is born and the whole point of the story is developed. Abraham's family is Israel. There are other parts to his family, but that's where it comes from. Abraham has a son called Isaac, who has two sons called Esau and Jacob. Esau becomes the father of the Edomites. Jacob becomes the father of the Israelites because Jacob has his name changed to Israel. So whenever you read Jacob, you can put the synonym Israel. They're the same, one and the same thing, Jacob and Israel. Now you can see the confusion, how it sets in, can't you? Here is a man whose name is Israel. Here is a nation which names Israel. 5/6 of it splinters off from the rest and calls itself Israel. So you get the word Israel and it can mean three different things. Can mean the man, can mean the whole nation, or can mean the northern kingdom of the whole nation. There is part of the ambiguity that once you pick that key up, things start to fall into place. Jacob changes his name to Israel and he has 12 sons, and those 12 sons become the fathers of the 12 tribes of Israel. One of his sons, Joseph, is sold into slavery into Egypt. During the Great Famine, the only way that the people could continue to live was by to go down to Egypt, and so the whole family migrates into Egypt under the favour of the Pharaoh. For 400 years they live there, but eventually we start to find that the Pharaohs do not know the people of Israel as being the descendants of a favoured man, Joseph. They treat them rather as slaves. And God raises up, in request of their prayers, a man to rescue them from slavery. That man, of course, is number four listed there. Number three I've put down as the Egypt, or Joseph, whichever you want to put it as. Number four is, of course, the man who rescues them out, the man called Moses. Moses takes them via the plagues out of the hands of Pharaoh, cross the wilderness, through the Red Sea, cross the wilderness again to Mount Sinai, where the constitution of Israel is set up. Canada's got a new constitution. As of this weekend, I understand, the Queen went over and signed the paper, and the Quebec people are not too happy and all the rest of it, but there is a new constitution with a Bill of Rights written at the front of it. Well, Israel's constitution and Bill of Rights is written by God at Mount Sinai when the people of Israel, led by Moses, are in the middle of the Exodus back from Egypt. It's called in biblical language a covenant. The purists amongst us are going up the wall at this point, at the difference between constitutions and covenants. Tough. That's the general idea of what it's about. It's a formal contract that establishes the nation. That's what it's about. God gives to the people there. He then leads them through the wilderness, through the desert for 40 years, because they break it immediately, they get it. In fact, they haven't even got the final copy before it, so the ink's not so much as dried, or the carving on the stone's not so much as dried, when the people are already breaking it. And so for 40 years they wander through the wilderness till they all die off, and then God leads them into the promised land. That brings to the end the Exodus. Moses is left then, and Joshua leads the conquest of the promised land. The promised land is Canaan, Palestine, if you like. Israel. You get another meaning of the word now. The promised land they come in and take under Joshua, and then after a series of men called the judges. There's a book of them. Not only men, there's some women who are the judges, of course. And they continue to try and take the land of Canaan away from the Canaanites. They are very bad at doing it because they keep on breaking the constitution. They keep on failing to keep the law given to them by God out at Mount Sinai with Moses. And so finally God appoints a king for them to fight the Canaanites. The first king is the king Saul, who's a disaster. Point number five under there is the judges. Point number six is the kings. In particular, there's one king I'd remind you because he's got a good date. Saul was the first king. He was a disaster and didn't help the cause very much. And the second king was the great king, David. And he's the one I've written down against number six. And he reigned in the year, this will be hard for you to remember, but it's important to get it, 1000 BC. Right? If you can cope with that figure, you're in business. Right? 1000 BC, David is on the throne. He is the most important king that ever reigned. He is the greatest king that ever reigned in Israel. If you can't remember any other king, remember David and you're in business, right? Every second Jewish boy has David in his name somewhere. Because David is the great one, right, of all the kings of Israel that ever lived. And at his point in time, all the other nations in Canaan and Palestine were subdued. They finally inherited the promised land, the inheritance. Indeed, they spread their borders all across the Middle East. Now, a secular historian at this point will say, yeah, well, that's because the Egyptians were pretty weak and there was no one over in the Tigris-Euphrates valleys. There was a power vacuum at the time. That's why David was as powerful as he was. True. The Bible would say, yeah, that's the way God arranged it. But he conquered and he held the Middle East was his. His son was Solomon, who ruled for a long period of time. And then after Solomon, Solomon's son was Rehoboam. Rehoboam was to rule in Jerusalem. But Rehoboam was none too smart. He taxed the people too much. They complained bitterly, so he taxed them some more. Sounds like some other politicians I know of. So the civil war broke out, and Jeroboam, there's always a problem and confusion there. Jeroboam took the northern 10 tribes of Israel into a new confederacy. There is the division in 922. I tell you how I learnt it for examination purposes. But I'm always glad that I did learn it for examination purposes because now I know it and I don't have to remember it this way. I did it alphabetically. North and Jeroboam and Israel all start with letters in the alphabet before South and Rehoboam and Judah. Right? So there's the figures, there's the names you've got, you see. Rehoboam and Jeroboam, which one comes first? Well, he's the one who's attached to the north, south, north, and he's the one, therefore, with Israel, see? That's how I learnt it. You learn it your way, if you like, but if you like my way, you can send me a commission later. But it's important to see that the two nations then flow down and they are destroyed. From here on in, it's bad news stories. You get those books of Kings where there's a series of kings, one after another, all the way down through the history. And they tell you a little bit about the king up in Israel and how rotten he is. And when he dies, they go back and recount all the kings that occurred in Judah during the time he lived. And then they tell you the last one. And by the time they tell you how he died, then they flip back over to Israel and tell you all about that and what's happened in there while they've been over at Judah. And then they flip back over to... And that's why the book's very hard to read, you see. You must keep a track with a piece of paper and a pencil of which king you're reading about in which kingdom, whether it's the north or south, to follow out the Book of Kings when you're reading it. Otherwise it just becomes a mind-boggling list of names of kings, all of whom did the rotter. Nearly all, anyway. Ultimately, the northern tribe, the northern confederacy, was destroyed by the Assyrians. The southern nation went on a little longer. They survived the Assyrians because of a good king called Hezekiah. He didn't write a book in the Bible, in case someone quotes a chapter from it. But they didn't last much longer and were taken off into captivity by the Babylonians. But the Babylonian Empire, great and mighty as it was very short-lived. The Persians, who took over from the Babylonians, sent the Israelites home. They're now called Israelites again, you see, although it's only Judah. Sent the nation of Israel, that is Judah and Benjamin, back home to rebuild. But they rebuilt under Persian rule. And when the Persian Empire was beaten by the Greeks, they continued under Greek rule. And ultimately they continued under Roman rule. And so from here on in, they're an occupied land. Now you get that in the last verse of Nehemiah, the passage that J.C. read for us, you see. That is, Nehemiah's in the time post-exilic, after the exile, rebuilding the city walls. And he says, but we're slaves. We're in the promised land. We're back in Palestine, but we're slaves. Other people own us, own our cattle, we're still in slavery. And they continue in occupied slavery down till Jesus. Jesus spreads the nation Israel to the Gentiles through the mission that takes place by his apostles, where the Messiah becomes the Messiah not for the nation of Israel in terms of the physical descendants of Abraham, but for the spiritual descendants of Abraham, those who are the men and women of faith. And so a new nature in Israel becomes apparent, and the whole world hears of the Messiah. In AD 70, the Romans move in and destroy the Temple of Israel, the Temple in Jerusalem. That's the third temple they've had, I may say. But that one is finally destroyed. The city is destroyed and ransacked. The nation is dispersed. There's another little kerfuffle in 135 with Bar Kokhba's revolt, but the nation as a nation is broken and exiled from there until, well, it depends whether you want to trace the present Israel back to them or not, but if you do, until 1948. But those who have their descendants there from the spiritual Abraham do not perceive that as being the same importance. All right, I'll run through it the second time, getting the details filled in. I'm not going to fill in any more details, because if you fill in any more details, then you lose the track of the overall again. Right? So I thought what I'll do is just a couple of other different things. Notice on the column beside the timeline that we've written some empires. They're not too specific, but they are generally in agreement with the timeline. Egypt comes and goes many times through the period of the history of Israel. But the time at which its power was most keenly felt amongst the Israelites was, of course, between points 3 and 4. That must be the time when it was most keenly felt, seeing they were in slavery in Egypt during that whole period of time. Assyria has its power during the divided monarchy. It had fallen by the wayside by the time of the Babylonian power. The Babylonian Empire was short and followed by the Persians and the Greeks. You'll notice that those ones are printed in capitals, uppercase. You might like to put the Romans after the Greece there, because Rome was the great power from there on in. They're in capital letters because they are the major world powers. They are the major ones. They're the United States and the Russians. of the ancient world. They're not the kind of middle-order powers, and they're not the local neighbours. The ones in small case there are like the local neighbours, the Philistines, the Syrians, the Phoenicians. There are others that you could put there, the Moabites, the Edomites, the Amalekites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, all those ites. You know, they're all over the countryside. They're little fellows, right? Very little fellows. And their kind of fighting that you might have is a kind of squabble between New Zealand and Australia. Right? It's that kind of proportion compared to Assyria, which is like America, right? And Egypt, which is like Russia. I mean, to the ancient reader, there's no trouble in differentiating those things like there's no trouble in differentiating these things now. Go for your life and fix it out, whatever it is, don't you? It's going to explode, especially. We're all fascinated, aren't we? I presume the urn is going a little too furiously and doesn't have a whistle on it. But that's a switch, I just heard it. Now, that difference in kind of the importance of the nation we're dealing with is key to our reading and understanding what it's about. See, if you turn to your two maps on the other side of the sheet, which do not have scales and do not have north points and other things like that which your geography teacher told you always to put on, notice the one that's entitled the Middle East. That's looking at the kind of whole area. And the great world powers occurred over in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. That's where the Assyrians, based on Nineveh, were. That's where the Babylonians, based on, you'd never guess it, but Babylon, were. Whereas the Egyptians are based on the River Nile. Palestine, right, which is just where that name is written, is halfway, especially remembering the Arabian Desert. No one wandered straight across the Arabian Desert, or no major power did. If you actually wanted to travel from the Tigris-Euphrates to Egypt, you travel down the fertile coastland of the Mediterranean Sea. That is, you travel through Palestine. So every time there was a warfare going, Palestine was caught in the middle of it. Those big nations, then, are the ones that are likely to destroy Israel forever. If you turn to the other map, though, the Palestine map, there's the Dead Sea, the Sea of Galilee, the top. Samaria is the capital of the northern tribes, the northern 10 tribes of Israel. Jerusalem is the capital of the southern 2 tribes called Judah. We stopped making this map for various reasons during the week, but you would find to the west of Judah, to the left-hand side, wedding ring side, over there you'll find that's where the Philistines lived. Just north of that, along the coastal, where just north of Galilee, along the coast, Mediterranean coast, that's where the Phoenicians were. The Moabites were just east of the Dead Sea. So were the Edomites. They are the kinds of people they're fighting. The Canaanites, of course, were right where Jerusalem and Samaria were. They were the ones that were evicted under the conquest. Now, they're little fellows. They're the little fellows of Palestine that are being fought. Certainly the battles with the Philistines gave them a great headache, and more than a headache, and the battles with these people are a great problem. But they were nothing compared to being invaded by the Assyrians. I mean, it's the difference between fighting New Zealand and fighting Russia. I think I know which I'd prefer. Although with Mr. Muldoon, it's a fairly tough question, actually. You can't be too sure what will happen there. Those kingdoms come and go. You'll notice on the right-hand column next to our timeline, again in rough accordance, there are the books of the Bible listed. Now, some books of the Bible, there's many that are not listed, some books of the Bible don't have any particular temporal importance. The book of Job, well, the book of Psalms, different Psalms have different timings, don't they? So you can't just link every book in. But the Genesis account has to do with the prehistory period, 1 to 11 of Genesis, the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Joseph, and the rest. Exodus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Leviticus, all have to do with the great Exodus, the great Egyptian event. Joshua and Judges have to do, and they should be a little bit lower down on the sheet, shouldn't they? Parallel to paint, say, about 4 to 5. Joshua and Judges has to do with the conquest of Palestine. Samuel has to do with the establishment of the kingdom in the first place and the first few kings under the united monarchy. the books of Kings has to do with the divided monarchy and the destruction of the kingdoms, the going into exile. The writing prophets tend to come after that. Isaiah speaks of the Assyrians and the Babylonians, Jeremiah of the Babylonians, Ezekiel of the Babylonians and after the Babylonians. Ezra and Nehemiah is the mopping up of the whole story account. Ezra and Nehemiah tell about the re-establishment of the kingdom after the exile. So the books of the Bible roughly follow the historical order of events, only roughly, because they are of a different character. But that's where you'll find those different areas. The customs, laws, institutions of Israel, such as, say, the covenant, the constitution, the sacrificial system, the tabernacle, which later became the temple, the inheritance, the promised land, all those kinds of things, are promised to Abraham. And then you see them set up during the Exodus. And you see them come to their fulfillment under the United Kingdom under David. And you see them abused under the divided kingdom and destroyed with the Assyrians and the Babylonian exile, and then reconstituted after the exile in a fairly paltry fashion. Well, that's enough, isn't it? How about you ask questions of where you want other bits and pieces fitted in, or things you don't feel confident about, or indeed corrections that you need to make to my historical recounting. The Book of Esther is a fascinating book, isn't it? Yes. I understand that Calvin commentated on every book of the Bible except for Revelation and Esther. Yes, I've never preached on Esther, I confess. It's got such women's lib statements in the first chapter now, everyone's going to read it, I tell you. Never has there been any. It's dealing with the captives under the Persians, isn't it? That is, doesn't Esther continue on in Babylon after Babylon has failed as a power? So it's down with Ezra and Nehemiah. Not all the people went home. See, after the people were allowed to go home from Babylon, many of them decided to stay. The water skiing, the trout fishing is very good in Babylon. And then as the generations wore on, the Jewish community of Babylon tried to be Jewish still, and Esther is an example of that. I'm off the top of my head, so please correct me if I'm wrong in that area. Eutyches? Eutyches was the man who was just dying to hear the word of God. It's Derek Howell's joke, wasn't it? Didn't Derek give us that one? He's the man who, listening to Paul late at night, fell out the window and killed himself. But he wasn't dead because he was raised up. So that's Eutyches, the young boy. He should be number 8 in your list, shouldn't he? Lillian? No, that's not. That's just someone working here. Other bits? Yeah, Paul. Yeah, thanks, Claude. The Northern Kingdom people, when the Assyrians came and destroyed them, they didn't kill every human being. Right? The first thing they killed lots of them, especially the leaders. They then took a large section of the community, especially the leadership of it, and scattered them all over the Assyrian Empire. We never hear of them again. You know, you just hear of different ones and twos who are Jewish people, but as a force, they're done for. They left behind, though, a group of Israelites. The Assyrian method of conquest, it was a clever one, though, because what they then did was take other captive people and put them into Israel. What the Babylonians did was it took everybody over to Babylon, basically. That was their idea. Whereas the Persians sent everybody back home. Whereas the Assyrians took everybody from their homeland and stuck them in other homelands, and then got them to intermarry with each other. Now, the Israelites, who intermarried with the other Assyrian captives, become the Samaritans in the New Testament. And why? Part of the reason they're so detested is that they were the half-castes. I mean, they were detested because they were the traitorous 10 northern tribes to start with. But then they got exactly what they deserved, to be bumped off by the Assyrians. But then some of them went ahead and married amongst the pagans. So they weren't really Jewish, were they? There are other reasons why the Samaritans and the Jews disliked each other. There were some quite shenanigans about defiling each other's temples and things like that. But that's where the Samaritans come from. Samaritans still exist today. Very strange and sad story, really. This is terribly relevancy, but just in case you'd ever need to know it, they do continue today. They intermarry very heavily, and there's been genetic diseases amongst them, and a small number of them continue, some several thousands now, and I've forgotten what it is. I think they're heavily inflicted with blindness, if I remember it. And because they only intermarry, the problem is compounding itself enormously. Very sad, the Samaritan story. And every true son of Judah would say, well, that's exactly what you expect. They also have another interest to us, the Samaritans, in that they preserved the first five books of the Old Testament independently of the people of Israel, people of Judah, you see. And so when you come to the New Testament, you've actually got two different traditions of the first five books of the Old Testament to compare and contrast with each other. Anyway, they're Samaritans. He will occupy the land and he will be a blessing to all the nations. Those promises are confirmed, are repeated to the other patriarchs. They're confirmed and repeated to the people of Israel in Exodus. They're confirmed and fulfilled in David. And each time they're confirmed, more details are given. Each time more details are provided. And then as the generations wore on, the Jewish community of Babylon tried to be Jewish still, and Esther is an example of that. I'm off the top of my head, so please correct me if I'm wrong in that area. Eutyches? Eutyches was the man who was just dying to hear the word of God. It's Derek Howell's joke, wasn't it? Didn't Derek give us that one? He's the man who, listening to Paul late at night, fell out the window and killed himself. But he wasn't dead because he was raised up. So that's Eutyches, the young boy. He should be number 8 in your list, shouldn't he? Lillian? No, that's not. That's just someone. Yeah. Other bits? Yeah, Paul. Yeah, thanks, Claude. The Northern Kingdom people, when the Assyrians came and destroyed them, they didn't kill every human being. Right? The first thing they killed lots of them, especially the leaders. They then took a large section of the community, especially the leadership of it, and scattered them all over the Assyrian Empire. We never hear of them again. You know, you just hear of different ones and twos who are Jewish people, but as a force, they're done for. They left behind, though, a group of Israelites. The Assyrian method of conquest, you see, was a clever one, though, because what they then did was take other captive people and put them into Israel. What the Babylonians did was it took everybody over to Babylon, basically. That was their idea. Whereas the Persians sent everybody back home. Whereas the Assyrians took everybody from their homeland and stuck them in other homelands, and then got them to intermarry with each other. Now, the Israelites, who intermarried with the other Assyrian captives, become the Samaritans in the New Testament. And why? Part of the reason they're so detested is that they were the half-castes. I mean, they were detested because they were the traitorous 10 northern tribes to start with. But then they got exactly what they deserved, to be bumped off by the Assyrians. But then some of them went ahead and married amongst the pagans. So they weren't really Jewish, were they? There are other reasons why the Samaritans and the Jews disliked each other. There were some quite shenanigans about defiling each other's temples and things like that. But that's where the Samaritans come from. Samaritans still exist today. Very strange and sad story, really. This is terribly relevancy, but just in case you'd ever need to know, they do continue today. They are intermarry very heavily, and there's been genetic diseases amongst them, and a small number of them continue, some several thousands now, and I've forgotten what it is. I think they're heavily inflicted with blindness, if I remember it. And because they only intermarry, the problem is compounding itself enormously. Very sad, the Samaritan story. And every true son of Judah would say, well, that's exactly what you expect. They also have another interest to us, the Samaritans, in that they preserved the first five books of the Old Testament independently of the people of Israel, people of Judah, you see. And so when you come to the New Testament, you've actually got two different traditions of the first five books of the Old Testament to compare and contrast with each other. Anyway, they're Samaritans. He will occupy the land and he will be a blessing to all the nations. Those promises are confirmed, are repeated to the other patriarchs. They're confirmed and repeated to the people of Israel in Exodus. They're confirmed and fulfilled in David. And each time they're confirmed, more details are given. Each time more details are provided. So by the time you come to David, you've got very explicit promises from God about his plans and his purposes, not only for his people, but even for his kings in the years to come. But yet the history of Israel is not only about the promises given and confirmed and repeated, not only about the promises coming true in the people like David, but also of the total loss of all that was promised in the division of the kingdom, in the destruction by the Assyrians, in the exile under the Babylonians, and in the weak and pitiful occupied Israel that existed from the time of Babylonia to the time of the New Testament. All the great promises of God seem to come to nothing. And the Bible is full of those songs like the Song of Babylon. How can we sing the songs of Babylon? We long for Zion, but here we sit in slavery in Babylon. Very sad song, irrespective of what some up-tempo rock singers may do to it today. Very sad song, heartbreaking and heart-rending, because everything is lost, and it's lost because of their sinfulness. That comes out in that Nehemiah story, doesn't it? Time and again you forgave us, you bore with us, you brought us back, you delivered us, you rescued us. Time and again we turned away from the law of Moses, we turned away from the constitution, the contract with God. And time and again we fell the hand of our enemies, until everything seems destroyed, and yet God's promises are to come true. Because of God's character, his purpose and his power, God will bring about his plan. And his plan is that Adam's fallen race will be restored and live to the praise and glory of God. Now that's a simplistic description of the plan. It's very complicated in places, but that's the general drift of it. That those opening 11 chapters are not irrelevant to the story. They're the fundamental backdrop to the story. That Adam and his race fell away from God. And God has the plan, which he had before he created Adam, I may say. God has the plan to restore Adam's fallen race. And the way he's going to do that is through a particular family. A particular member of that family, the last Adam, Jesus, whom he raised from the dead. And through that family, salvation comes to the nations, and people are raised to live to the glory of God. It's all under God's plan, and the whole history of Israel is the outworking of God's plan. That's why certain facts, certain dates, certain times are important, because at certain points, key things happen for the outworking of God's plan. And that seems to me to be the Bible's understanding of history, the Bible's understanding of humanity, of the affairs of men. It's God in control of all the affairs of men.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.